Still Alive, a look at people making things. The Record Cutter. Peter Brooks meets John Downing.
I'm with John of Do It This End Records, and we're going into his studio to lathe cut a vinyl record. We're in a very warm, compact room with a rack full of electronics in the corner, what looks like an air pump on the floor, and a record deck with some complex engineering built on the back of it. John's going to power everything up, explain what it's all for, and we'll make a start.
OK, so over in this rack here that you can see, we've got the amplifier for the cutting heads, we've got the amplifier for playback, we've got the main unit which processes the signal from the CD player, which is on the top there. So basically, the CD has the music that I'm going to cut on it, and that's fed through all the electronic gear there. Comes out down those wires and into the cutting head. And like you see, the cutting head is on a frame on the top of the record deck, which is has two functions. That's to it's the platter which the blank is placed on, and it's also used. We use the tone arm of the deck to play back through the output through the mixer, and then hence the speakers or my headphones. So you can see the cutting head is on an arm, and when the platter's turning and the blank's heated up to the right temperature, we switch it all on and the head moves across there slowly while the platter's turning, so we're cutting the groove into the record fed from the music that's coming from the CD. And that whooshing noise in the background there that's where the swarf is being sucked out from behind the cutting stylus by a vacuum pump, which puts the swarf into that little bottle there, and the tube snakes out through the window with the air that's been sucked through.
So the actual cutting head, that just looks like a pair of loudspeakers with something coming out the middle. Is that what it is?
Yes, it is, mate. It's like two tweeters that's configured with a sort of an arrangement of wire rods that holds the cutting stylus, which is a diamond that is used to cut into the wall blank that's rotating on the platter.
And the rest of it, I mean, it looks to me like a pretty much a standard domestic record turntable, but with an extra bit built onto the back of it. Is that a fair description, you think?
Yeah, that's right. I'm using a Technics 1210 there, and that's those decks were chosen because they're industry standard. They're very well engineered, and they've got a good torque on them, so that when you're cutting, like for instance, a 12-inch single, you've not got typically on a weaker or less well-engineered deck, you'd perhaps get a lot of wow and flutter. So this is a really good sort of workhorse sort of engine to use as the basis for the lathe.
But I see you've got racks of blank vinyl over on the other side of the room here. What's are these all the same thing? Are they just different sizes, or is there?
Yeah, that's it. Well, the lathe cut starts off life as a blank piece of polycarbonate cut to the right dimensions. So I've got 5-inch, 7-inch, 8-inch, 10-inch, 12-inch. And I've got them in thin, really thin sizes, like 1 millimetre. That's not quite a flexidisc, but it's fairly sort of wobbly. 1.5 millimetre, 2 millimetre. And I've got them in black, clear. And from another supplier, I've got some 7-inch with the DJ centre, and I've got those in green, blue, red, white.
So if I'm a band, I can pretty much choose something special for my single then, can't I?
That's right. Part of the discussions when I'm going to put something out by band is what sort of format we're going to do. So it depends how long the tracks are, what the duration is, and how many tracks they've got. So it might be the case that if it's just something as simple as like 3.5 minutes tracks on each side, we might be able to do something a bit different and put it on a coloured blank, which makes it a bit different rather than the standard bog standard black.
You mentioned to me before that the vinyl needs to warm, or some of the vinyls need to warm up to the correct temperature. So whilst that's doing, what are the other factors you have to take into account? Presumably the length of the track, for example, is an issue.
Yes, a number of factors involved when you're working out what you can put onto a blank. There's the duration of the track, there's the amount of bass on the track, and there's also how loud you want the record cutting. So you can usually have... You can have two, but not all three. So, for instance, if you've, say, got a single that's a track that's 5 or 6 minutes long, that would fit on a 7-inch, one side of a 7-inch, but it would be so quiet that you probably wouldn't want it on there. So you can, the idea is then you could perhaps put that on an 8-inch or a 10-inch, where you could have it a bit louder. So there are a number of factors in play on those three aspects, and that's part of the discussion with a band when we're talking about a release.
Yeah, that's interesting, because obviously I've come across, there's a traditional 7-inch single, you know, the old 45 size thing, but then 10-inch singles, well, I always thought it was just somebody fancied doing it on a 10-inch record for whatever reason, didn't really realise that it was a, you know, there's a technical issue behind it as well.
When bands have got, say, four tracks that maybe last about 10 minutes, then a 10-inch EP at 45 is a good way to accommodate those.
Okay, so I think we're about ready to actually start cutting now. So what's this track we're going to be producing now, John?
Right, we've got a track called Do As You're Told by local band Surreal Appeal.
This track's fairly long, so while it's cutting, I'm going to have a chat with one of the band members to find out more about their record.
My name's Sophie, I'm from Surreal Appeal, and I've known John for many years, and we had put together an album just before I had a baby, and he might be able to hear in the background. And so obviously before, I've been in bands before where we've pressed records, and you have to, you know, sort of classically when you go to a pressing plant, you have to press 500 minimum, and that's quite wasteful for the environment, but also, you know, it's very expensive. And I knew John was doing limited runs, and it seemed really a great little DIY ethic that he had going on. So I'd messaged John about it, and he said, oh, I've been meaning to contact you. And I was like, oh, great. And so I sent him the music, and he said, yeah, let's go for it. So I really liked the idea that there was just like 30 copies and that it was a little collector's item. And so, yeah, that's how it kind of came about. So it was really nice. I think then that, you know, it becomes a bit special that there was only 30 copies made and I don't have, you know, sort of 499 records in my attic. That's a bonus, really.
You mentioned experience of having other records pressed. So you've been in several bands, I guess, not just the one you're in now.
Just to sort of go over my history, I was collecting records from probably 14, 15, DJing by the time I was about sort of 16, 17. Did a music degree. I've been in various bands, Kings of Long Arms, The Cuckoo Clocks, and now Surreal Appeal. I worked for a record label, a little independent record label in London, doing Northern A&R for a number of years as well. So we put out like iMonster and Jackknife Lee and Geezers of Nazareth, which is Hugo Nicholson from Primal Scream. So we put out lots of little 7-inch records, and they were quite nice sort of 7-inch records, really. We just do a limited run. So, yeah, I've got a history in working in record shops, working for... So I've been DJing for about 25 years, and now I'm kind of a record collector, and I still DJ, but I'm really interested in, you know, collecting music and stuff and making music. So I suppose that natural progression from listener to maker.
Why do you think vinyl's become popular again? Because it virtually disappeared at one point.
Yeah, I mean, I remember sort of so clearly... because I moved to Sheffield in 2000 and started working in record shops. At one point, I was working in probably about four record shops just trying to earn a living. And then sort of ironically, I got offered a job working for a digital music distribution company, so sending music to Spotify and iTunes and things. And because at that point, people were coming into the record shops with suitcases full of CDs and records and trying to get rid of it. Oh, I've got iTunes now. I've got Spotify now. And I knew it was becoming really hard. And then, you know, now the honeymoon period of the digital thing sort of has gone over. I think people are realising that there's an intimacy, I think, with records that you just cannot have with a download. You know, the artwork, holding it in your hand, it's kind of a little bit romantic, putting a record, when you've got some friends around, putting a record on the deck and the needle on the record, it's the process. There's something really appealing about all that process to me, and also the sound quality. And, you know, I mean, I've got that many CDs that just a tiny scratch and it won't play, whereas the crackles on records have sort of become the appealing thing about them in time, you know. It's like, oh yes, that crackle. But I just, yeah, it's, they're sort of pieces of artwork, but also history as well, I think, you know. And maybe I became a bit of a hypocrite, really, working for selling downloads for a living. But then when I left that job now, I, you know, might listen to something digitally, but then I'll buy the physical version of that. But yeah, I think vinyl has come back, in answering your question, because the honeymoon period of digital is over a bit, and there's, you know, a lot of backlash with artists not really getting paid properly on Spotify. And yeah, there's an outlay with physical, but you do get much more for your money with, you know, selling records than you would downloads, you know, as an artist. But I think as a consumer, on all levels, it's, records are just nicer and sound nicer.
Well, I've always felt it's I always enjoy, you know, you put a record on, listen to it, and then you can sit and read the sleeve notes.
Of course.
Like who's playing and what's the song about, and maybe the lyrics.
Yeah.
All that kind of thing, which you obviously can't do with a download, can you? So it's,
no, there's I was in a record shop sort of last year, and somebody was, the person in the record shop was playing a record by Mandingo, and Mandingo were a sort of session musicians that had come off tour, and they just got together in the studio. Sorry about this. So they were playing a Mandingo record, and I basically was like, oh, what's this? And it was a really amazing sounding thing, and it was just some musicians that had just got together and had a jam, and somebody pressed it on a record, and it was just something really like, and reading all the notes, you were going, oh yes, that musician from that band. And it was really interesting, a historical list of all these people. And like you say, I just think you know, it's, you're more connected to it, aren't you, by reading it. But yeah, there's something really nice about a record, I think, and putting it on and playing it, and like you say, reading those notes. And I think that it's just come full circle again. People realise that actually, and you know, there's a lot of you know, lots of records getting repressed, and you know, I think that it's, you know, having a record player. We just bought my stepson a really nice record player for his 21st, and he was so chuffed, and I was really pleased that he, you know, somebody who's 21 buys records, you know.
So, who did you get to do the artwork for it?
So Michael Eden did the artwork. So basically he photographed all our faces and then spliced it. So the idea was, I think it was because it had Peel in the title of the artist's name, but he did this amazing kind of strip of each of our faces, but really mixed it up. So it's come up with this new kind of face, but I think it's really clever what he's done. So Michael did the album cover, and then we did a 7-inch single, and then a 10-inch supporting the album. So Grace in the band, she did a lot of the visual. We've got a lot of visuals actually for when we play live, which is something we're hoping to do in the next few months. And so Grace did the artwork for the 7, but Michael had done us an amazing logo and sort of spliced image of parts of all of our faces. And it kind of, it does look a bit weird, but it's quite cool. So, yeah, we were really pleased with it. But, yeah, Michael Eden did the album artwork.
I'm off back to the studio now to catch up with the cutting, then have another chat with John about how this idea all started. So that's the first one finished then, John. How many more have you got to do for this particular release?
OK, this release is in a run of 40, so just another 39 to go.
How did you get into this then?
The thing that came first was the record label. I was sort of approaching what I thought might be a good time to retire from full-time work in IT. Something to sort of keep me active and out of mischief was to have a record label. So that was the way into it, really. I started off with doing pressed vinyl records, and When I'd done several of those, it just occurred to me, I had a light bulb moment, because I was buying a lot of lathe cut records myself. I thought that, well, maybe this is something I could do. I wasn't too sure if I'd got the audio or mechanical or electronic sort of skills to do it. So it took a bit of thinking about.
Pressed vinyl is the sort of traditional way that, you know, a David Bowie record would have been done, 10,000 at a time.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the machinery for that costs hundreds of thousands of pounds, and it's geared up as a sort of an industrial scale activity to produce, as you say, you know, thousands and thousands of records at a time, whereas I'm just looking to produce a handful. I mean, I can just cut one if one's all that's required. But typically just small runs, 25... 30, 40 singles.
So how did you actually get into the process of lathe cutting? You know, it's not something you're born with. You need to learn it and develop it, I suppose.
No, that's right. Like I said, I wondered if I did have the skills. So I thought a good idea would be to see if I could find somebody with a lathe and have a go. And through looking at the online forums about lathe cutting, I managed to find a guy in Manchester who had a lathe. So I got in touch with him and arranged to spend a day with him, just basically hands-on, seeing if it was something that I felt comfortable with. I think by the end of the day, I cut a whole lot of records on from tracks I've got on CD, and that gave me the confidence to pursue it further.
Are there many of them around then? I mean, you said you're in Sheffield, there's one in Manchester, is it?
I think when I was doing a bit of research around, you know, what it was like in the UK for lathe cutters, I think I found about 30, I think, people, on the internet anyway, who offer lathe cutting as a service, if you like. So there's probably hundreds more hobbyists who just don't bother to advertise or offer a service to cut records.
In a country the size of the UK, that's not many, though, is it? I mean, that's few and far between, dotted around, really.
That's right, and mostly in the southeast, I think, as well. Yeah, not so many up here or in Scotland.
So having gained the confidence that you could do it, I guess the next step was to actually get hold of a lathe for yourself, then.
There are all sorts of lathes available. Well, I'm talking about stuff that had been produced back in the day in the sort of 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. Lots of second-hand ones that would perhaps need a lot of renovation and not particularly hi-fi. These would be very basic, although, of course, there are lathes from that time which are really high fidelity, but which are so expensive to find and run and repair. But at the moment, there's a guy in Germany who made a lathe, invented, it's his own invention, I think, back in the 80s, I think. And he's been going a few years, and he's based out of a disused railway station in Germany near the Black Forest, middle of nowhere. And he has a website, and the details about quite a lot of the lathe cut process, and also he's got a list of the equipment that's needed. Now, it's not the case that you can just tick a few boxes and send off some money to him and he'll send it to you. I think you've got to persuade him that you're an ideal person to have one of his lathes. So I entered into an email correspondence with him, and I must have said the right things, because a short while later I got an invitation to go to Germany for training and to buy a lathe. So it's the idea is that you go to Germany for the weekend and you spend the whole day and the whole of the Saturday cutting. And at the end of the day, you decide whether or not you want one, and cash changes hands, and that's it. You're a proud owner of a lathe.
It's almost like a mini apprenticeship, isn't it? Just to get the seal of approval from the guy.
I guess, yes. It's I think he likes to know that his machines are going to good homes.
I believe you took a particular record with you to use as the basis of the, or not a record, some tracks to use as the basis of the session.
Yes, part of the deal was that the guy in Germany says, well, bring some tracks on CD, and we'll use the CD as the input for the cutting process. And around that time, I'd got some tracks from Mick Ward in his band Mazilky Pop. So along with a few other tracks, some other local bands, I took those with me, and I cut a few of those. And eventually, after I got the lathe, I actually issued that album as a lathe cut, edition of 25, which was a bit of a baptism of fire, because I think it's the case that 12-inch lathe cuts are perhaps technically the most hard to do. And you've got like 20 minutes of music aside. yes, it was a good it was a good training.
Well, I was lucky enough to track down Mick Ward, and we've got a few words from him now.
I started out in music. Really, the most significant beginning was when I was a member of a band called Clock DVA. This is the early 80s, quite an iconic Sheffield group from that period. I left them and signed to Virgin Records, like a number of other contemporaries, the Human League, Cabaret Voltaire, Heaven 17, for example. And I went to the United States and I made two albums there with Don Was Not Was. And that was the start of my career, really. One of the records had a big hit taken off it, recorded by Alison Moyet. And it became a perennial worldwide hit. And I basically became a sort of gun for hire songwriter, musician. My own project is Mazilky Pop. And I think this leads me back to what we're talking about today, because I did this album. It was a labor of love. And I offered the album to John Downing when I first found out he was actually the first person to buy the download, and he took it to Germany and he cut it when he was buying the lathe and brought it back with him and made some lathe copies. He also liked it so much that he ended up investing in it, having it pressed in Poland in beautiful red vinyl in the double sleeve. He showed a lot of faith in the record. As I said, very much a labour of love, and you'd have to hear it. It features Sylwia Duval, who is Polish. Kiedy Wilki Zawieją is the title. That's a Polish, and it means when will the wolves howl?
In case you're wondering, the big hit was Weak in the Presence of Beauty. I'm joining John again now to talk a bit more about his Do It This End label, other bands he's worked with, and just how many records he's made.
Well, it's a bit cheesy, isn't it? But Do It This End is Yorkshire for Do It Yourself. And this harks back to 2012 when, along with a friend, Matthew Cheeseman, who was at the University of Sheffield at the time, we put forward a proposal for the forthcoming Festival of the Mind event, which started in 2012. And we thought about doing something that reflected the local music scene, which sort of used as its basis on my collection of records and posters and fanzines from the late 70s to the early 80s. And just for a short, snappy title for the event, we called it Do It This End, which sort of summed it all up rather than... That exhibition lasted for a week, and that was really all about the local music scene of the late 70s to the early 80s. So basically, after the success of the exhibition, that phrase, Do It This End, was in my head when I was thinking of putting together a label. So on the label there are 20 or so artists, local artists, for whom I've cut records. In terms of releases on the label, I'm up to number 41 at the minute. There's a couple of gaps in there for works in progress. And that equates to about 3,000 or so lathe cuts, but of the pressed vinyl releases, there are several hundred for each of those.
So 3,000, that's a fair bit of your time, isn't it, spent individually cutting people's work?
That's true. It's one at a time in real time. So, yes, if an album's got 20 minutes aside, that's 20 minutes aside spent under a hot light with the lathe going and all the sounds of the studio.
That's a labour of love.
Yes, it is a labour of love, but I enjoy doing it. It's helping the local music scene, and it's putting something back, I guess. I've enjoyed it over the last 40-odd years since I came back to Sheffield, so... It's I like helping.
So out of those 40 or so releases then, John, are they all similar types of music or completely different?
I try and release records from a number of different styles, really. My favourite will be electronica and noisy garage rock. But we've had a fair mixture over the years. So we've got the likes of the Mighties, indie pop, Smaragdus, dungeon synth. We've got Nagwalls with their noisy rock. We've got The Morning After with garage rock. We've got Pulse Lovers, which is electronica. Beam Weapons, which is, well, I don't know how to describe that. And the latest release is Glam Rock by The Volts.
That's a fair old selection of different stuff then, isn't it? When you're actually cutting it, John, how do you know that it's going to sound okay when it's finished?
Well, what we tend to do is when we get some new tracks in to put on a lathe cut, is to do a test cut. So effectively, I get the tracks and by altering the amount of bass, mid and treble going in and altering the loudness, we can start cutting and then putting the tone arm of the deck into the groove just cut. And using the mixer, we can flick between the source music going in and what's being cut. And then can see that if it sounds like what they're expecting, and if not, then I can make some adjustments. And when that's done, I've got the settings. I make a note on my little database there. And then I can replicate that. Then it's a case of if we're cutting 25 singles, then I can just use those same settings and cut the 25.
The record cutter is John Downing.
Hey, it's too confusing. Yes, I'm refusing. Is it amusing? Well, I'm still refusing.
The musicians are Mick Somerset Ward and Sophie Stone.
Hey, do as you're told. When you get old, do as you're told.
The Still Alive theme music was composed and played by Frank Birtwistle. The making of Still Alive was supported by the Audio Content Fund.
Hey, it's that smell again, the empty shell again, when I close my eyes. When I close my eyes, I don't know when.
Still Alive is presented and produced by Peter Brooks for UpperHearst.com.